Hey, everybody. You're listening to a Partially Derivative interview. In this interview, I talked with Anil Dash, who you're probably already familiar with, but just in case you're not, he's been an entrepreneur, writer, and technologist for 20 years. These days, he's focused entirely on activism and making sure the tech industry is ethical. He's also on the board of the Data and Society Research Institute, and he's interested in the effects of data science, especially on the most vulnerable. It was a super interesting conversation. Let's check it out. All right. Thanks, Anil. Thank you so much for being on the show. We're really excited to have you. I think this is going to be a conversation that I think resonates with a lot of our listeners. So thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So I guess we can just dive right into it. I think data and the technologies enabled by data, like machine learning or artificial intelligence more broadly, are having a huge impact on our society. And I think things are changing very quickly. And so there's been a lot of discussion recently about ethics in data science, ethics in the application of these new technologies. And this is an area where you really focus. How have you been thinking about both data science and artificial intelligence in terms of its impact on society and culture?
Well, one of the things that's jumped out to me a lot is, you know, the ideas of thinking about social impact, of civic impact, of how especially vulnerable populations are affected by any change in society. These are mature areas. These are disciplines that in some cases go back hundreds of years. Yet what we don't have is a connection from them into tech culture broadly and data practice specifically, right? So the example I always use, and it really just has stuck with me as sort of a dramatic example, is other professions. If we look at medicine, law, journalism, business, any of those, if you go to business school, you're going to have a minimum amount of ethical training that you'll have to take. And the same is true if you want to get your doctor's license or to be a practicing lawyer. And you can go to some of the best, computer science or data science training or, some of the best universities in the world and have almost no ethics curriculum, in some cases none, right? And so what we have is this gap between what we know we need to become good practitioners and what we're actually teaching folks. And I think it's not – and I want to be cautious. Like, the people I know who do data science are good people. The intentions are always good. I don't think there's any malicious intent. But if we don't even have a basic literacy, a basic fluency in what are the kinds of issues that come up, where have we seen patterns of abuse or misuse or unintended consequences in the past, then what are we going to learn from, right? We don't have the data about data at this point to be able to say, well, this is what happens. This is who tends to be victimized or become vulnerable. So that's really the starting point, is that we know there can be unintended consequences. Everybody's heard all these sort of, whether it's legitimate or not, the different scare stories. What we don't have is a real community of practice around talking to each other and baking into our practice of learning how the work around data can have ethical implications.
Well, I think you touched on something just briefly about a lack of data about data or a lack of data about the application of the technologies around it. I mean, do you see that as being part of the core reason why this kind of ethical training or why this isn't a community discussion or an academic discussion? I mean, I guess, why is there this gap when it's present in all these other professions?
Some of this is immaturity, right? Like, we're a young industry, and the practice of these things and the fact that they can have global impact is actually a relatively new phenomenon. I'm middle-aged. I'm old enough to remember that technology in its entirety was this sort of novel space and for the geeks, and they did that over there in the corner, and it didn't really affect, quote-unquote normal people. and then in the interim, everybody got a supercomputer in their pocket. But we didn't really update our perceptions of what technology means for that reality, right? And so that, I think, there's no malicious bad actors for the most part. There's some, but that's a pretty rare thing. What it ends up being most often is people are busy. People are not familiar with some of these new areas. And also, anybody who has these skills right now is in extremely high demand, right? Everybody in the world is like, well, boy, if we could just get a data scientist, that would fix all our problems. And this is the sort of, right, and this is the hot new field, and tell your kids to go study this. And so when it, and with good reason, right? Again, like most of the people doing this work are doing amazing, you know, cutting edge applications of it. But what that means is if everybody in the world is saying you are the most talented, most in demand, most important, you know, future of work kind of worker that's out there, it's really, really hard to say, boy, in what ways am I prone to making mistakes or inadvertently causing error or misapplying this power? In particular, I think one of the biggest risk areas is that things that in, say, the realm of physical infrastructure, if we talk about building transit systems or, you know, sort of large-scale infrastructure, would require lots of people weighing in over a long period of time to make decisions that would impact communities or neighborhoods or something like that. Those kinds of decisions are made in the online world, in the digital world, sometimes by a single person and sometimes under tight deadlines, under duress, while they're trying to get something shipped or out, you know, the customers are making an update, like, we'll fix it later. And especially when we have a culture that is explicitly about, like, ship it now, broken, and we'll fix it later because it's always in beta. And that set of assumptions leaves us having people who are, again, even if they're well-intentioned and well-qualified within the data world, it leaves them making decisions that impact people's lives on, at a, you know, a fundamental level. It leaves them making these decisions, and they may not be equipped to do so. And I look at examples like, you know, all these sort of sharing economy apps that studiously discourage people from tipping the workers that are doing the work. And, you know, often they'll make that kind of value judgment decision based on what the data show. Well, it's like, well, you know, and it can be a couple different ways. One can be, well, we think over time the wages will balance out to ahead of what they had, you know, if they had been tipped, or more harmfully, or a data show that most users don't like to tip and that it adds a lot of friction to the process, so we want to take that out. So a lot of these things that are – and, of course, that has enormous impacts on the workers. But that sort of idea that, well, I'm going to move this one little button in an app based on what the data show, or I'm going to provide to a UI designer the data that might lead to them making that decision and not take back with it, well, what's the impact on somebody's, you know, take-home pay and their quality of life? Those things are really easy to get disconnected in the processes that we have today. And that's a thing that it's not obvious. It's not intuitive. And it doesn't feature a, you know, mustache twirling villain that's trying to hurt somebody. And so there's a real challenge to talking about it and articulating it and to, frankly, to holding each other accountable.
And I think you touched on something right at the end there that is an interesting, perhaps a next step. I mean, what do you see as being the forces for change where we do start to hold each other accountable for the impact of the technologies that we're producing?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple prongs for this. I think, you know, you start with, to some degree, consumer education, I think, is going to be a big part of this. You know, if consumers can be, have become so literate in things, you know, as widely ranging as, like, how many miles their food travels to get to their Whole Foods store, to whether the materials that make up their clothing are recyclable, to where, you know, the components of the things they purchase are sourced. Like, there are a lot of issues that we've, as consumers, have become very, very sophisticated about. And it's not, to me, difficult to imagine us becoming increasingly sophisticated about our data exhaust and the output of what we do and who has visibility into the data that we generate. And, you know, we don't even yet have the good housekeeping seals, you know, to sort of document where our information goes and who it flows to and the ways that it's connected. But it's easy to imagine how we could start to do so and start to – and, you know, I don't think the majority of users are going to make some affirmative declaration about this is how I would like my data to be used. But we can set a set of broad guidelines that can help them at least understand what risks they're taking, what choices they're making when they do so. So that's, like, one extreme, is the consumer education, putting a little bit of the control and, of course, some of the burden on in the hands of the people using technologies that generate data and that create data. You know, the other extreme, and it's one that I think the tech industry in particular has an aversion to, is regulation. You know, I call me old-fashioned, but there used to be a time when if there was a risk of great public harm, we would make laws about it. I don't think it's impossible to revisit that. I think, one, just the culture of reluctance in a lot of tech companies to even engage with policymakers is going to actually drive them towards making laws. And, you know, it's a shame because I look at, you know, here in the U.S., Dianne Feinstein is, you know, the senator for Silicon Valley. She's from California, and she's making laws about things like cryptography. And the proposed regulations are actually shockingly illiterate, right? And I thought, well, if she's the one getting her money from Silicon Valley, has access to them, just proximate to them, and is still making really terrible regulations, and I just mean that from a competence standpoint. Like, I don't even have a, you know, like, separate from whether you agree or disagree with what the point of her regulation is, it's just not very literate in the issue. That's terrifying, right? And so to some degree, I understand why so many in the tech industry reflexively think regulation is bad. On the other hand, disengaging with it or wishing it away is not really going to solve the problem. And in some cases where companies are actively resisting accountability, it might be our only path forward. Because, you know, to me, it's very shocking where a company that is publicly stated it's very, very data-driven, like Uber, also has as a strategy going to new cities and you know, essentially violating their taxi and transit regulations as their way of entering a market. And now some of those taxi, you know, regulations are corrupt, and certainly some of the people behind those laws don't have good intentions or consumer-friendly intentions in what they're doing. On the other hand, we can't really countenance lawbreaking as a strategy. That's a pretty bad precedent to set. And then especially it's bad because we think about, well, what if Uber did abuse our data or take advantage of it or use it in ways we didn't want? And then we say, we ask regulators to rein them in, and they say, well, we don't follow what those regulators say. We're not under the auspices of your taxi commission or whoever it is you have running. Those are really bad failure states, right, where we don't have any accountability and we don't have any recourse, and we have set a precedent of not listening to the few checks and balances that we have. That is a really toxic dynamic that I would like to, you know, prevent if we can. I'd like to stop us before we get down that path.
I think you bring up some really good points about the animosity between the tech industry and government. It's one that I've certainly experienced in the research community, doing things that have some kind of potentially some potentially complicated security implications. And you can, there's such a divide. I guess how do you see that working well? How do you see those two different ideologies, one where sort of the path is maybe based in regulation? People think about things in terms of years, whereas most startups think about things in terms of, you know, days and weeks and months, if they're very mature, like Uber.
Yeah,
So how do you see those two things reconciling?
Well, there has to be a cultural change. I mean, there's no two ways about it. There's a reckoning coming where, and it's interesting to me because people can say, well, my company doesn't do that. You know, that company over there, you know, whatever, Uber, Facebook, whatever, they might be creepy and weird and you don't like what they're doing, but my company doesn't do that. And the truth of it is, I think if you've got your thumb on the glass of your phone and you're a casual user, it's kind of all one company. I mean, it's all one app. It doesn't really matter where it's sourced from. It's like that app on my phone that has access to my, you know, address book or whatever else, or my photos of my kid or whatever it is. They're kind of all one big blob. And if one of them violates my trust, I don't trust any of them. And that idea of, you know, fairly or unfairly, that we're all going to be painted with the same brush, sort of hasn't sunk in yet. Interestingly, if you talk to designers of apps, you say, well, do you ever reuse design patterns or language or visuals from other apps? Are like, of course, you want it to look similar and familiar to other apps so users know how to use it. So you put the buttons here just like on this other app, and you know, that helps the user. And say, well, okay, if all the apps, and you know, there's a certain similarity to all the apps on an Android phone or an iOS phone. And say, well, all these apps look similar and they all hear they're all from Silicon Valley, and two or three of them have violated your trust and used your information in ways you didn't expect. What's the logical inference to draw? Is to think that similarities are only skin deep, or to think much more likely that the way they treat our data is as similar as the way they treat their user interface?
And then in terms of how consumers respond to that breach of trust with, in this case, the technology industry in general. Do you see a parallel in the way that a parallel to, for example, the way that consumers behaved when the apparel industry breached their trust? I mean, you kind of brought it up a little bit earlier. We think about who's making our clothes, even in terms of what are the conditions of the of the factory in which those clothes are made? How do those clothes get shipped to me? How does that impact the cost? What are the materials involved? Like, what are some ways in which we might put that kind of critical thinking into practice? And maybe in terms of awareness about the different ways that people might want to engage with these companies or hold them accountable as consumers.
So that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, one, for consumer awareness of things like sweatshop labor and material sourcing and those things to come to bear took, you know, decades, sometimes a century of work, right? It takes a long time. And it happened, you know, in the case of labor, at the behest of movements like labor movement, which have largely been gutted in the years since. Right? I don't think we have a healthy and strong enough labor movement to have a sort of, you know, anti-sweatshop movement begin today, which is a larger problem, but that's sort of, here's the reality that we're in. And so what I look at is like, what are the civil society institutions that could help raise awareness or that could give voice to these concerns? You know, and one of them, which I'm on the board of, is the Data and Society Institute. And, you know, there you have researchers going at this from almost every angle. And I mean, that's the one I'm affiliated with, but I think a lot of spaces in academia in particular are looking at a lot of these issues. And so that first step of, let's just get the information, let's get the data enough to be able to say with confidence, well, this is how your information is being treated, or you know, or are we being paranoid? I mean, I think in some cases that's happens too, is there's a panic about something and it's not really proportional to the actual risk, right? Where you know, these days I guess the boogeyman is algorithm, right? Everything's an algorithm, but in pop culture, algorithm means that big scary math. And you know, that sort of like I said, I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And so the way to change that is, one, with organizations and institutions educating the public, I think we have to make a really concerted effort to educate our regulators and lawmakers and to elect you know, policymakers who are even moderately literate in this stuff. I mean, I think we have, what, 600 and some members of Congress, and I would be shocked if five of them know how to install an app. you know, and that's, and you know, like, they're nice enough people, but that, and I don't think we've ever had someone who knows how to code elected to, you know, federal office. So, which is astonishing, right? Like, cause it's, there are now millions of Americans who know how to code. Like, we don't have enough programmers, but like, the reality is if it's a basic level literacy in broadly understanding how code works, which I think is a huge leg up in being able to make good policy about things like data, the fact that none of us have ever gotten elected to, you know, meaningful office at the federal level is a shocking shortcoming. And that's on us. You know, we have to encourage people to run and to participate. And you know, I always tell people, you know, who are worried about this stuff, who, you know, I used to make my living as a coder. I'm not a great coder anymore, if I ever was. But, you know, at least I've kept a level of literacy, and I like to try out, you know, whatever, the new toolkits and things as they come out. It's like, if you have time to do that, to try out, well, here's a new library and I want to hack around with it over the weekend, then you also have time to go to, you know, city council meetings and write to your state representative and say, you know, I'm actually literate in this stuff and want to make sure we're making good regulation about it, because there are hundreds, maybe thousands of laws being passed at the state and local level, let alone federal law, that are going to, in many ways, shape what happens. And if we want them to reflect our concerns and to protect our privacy and protect our security, then we have to articulate that. Or if we think they're going to overstep and they're illiterate in tech and they're going to break things that are good and you know, throw some babies out with the bathwater, then we need to step in there too. In either case, it's about kind of old-fashioned civics, you know, showing up, rolling up your sleeves, talking to people and telling them what you know.
I think that's actually a great place to leave it. I think there's a real call to action there for the technology community to engage. I think it's actually a very engaged population, but to actually well, to think about the way that they're engaging in or sort of upholding their civic responsibility in a way that they might not think is accessible to them normally. I think, like you've pointed out, there's a little bit of a cultural disconnect between the tech community and government at the local and definitely at the federal level, in my experience. And actually changing that culture on both sides, to one on the sort of the government side being more friendly and amenable to the interests of the tech community, but at the same time for technologists to engage in that kind of old-fashioned way, is, I think, it's a great place to start.
Absolutely. I really hope we can all do that.
I guess before I let you go, is there anything that anything I should have asked but didn't? Anything that's important?
That's a great question. I think one of the things I would love to see is more dialogue in amongst those who create the technology that is self-critical, to really recognize when we tell even our friends, hey, you know, this might be – this feature that you made is really cool, but it might put somebody at risk. And the example I keep coming back to, I'm a New Yorker. You know, we've got kids here in New York City that are being picked up by NYPD because they are asserting on social media that they're members of gangs. And having been a stupid teenage boy myself not that long ago, I would certainly say all kinds of random things to try and look cool to my friends, whether or not they were actually true. And I think what we've done is we, you know, have made tools that make it possible to monitor for that and to capture that. And then we have handed the data over to people that might not know how to interpret it fairly and take kids who are already at risk. And, you know, certainly if a kid gets picked up for claiming on Instagram to be a gang member when he's not, by the time he gets out of jail for being held for those charges, he probably will become one. And so those sorts of unexpected and really severe consequences to building tools that are, you know, originally born to what track brand mentions or something else like that, those are really unexpected and kind of terrifying side effects that we don't think about when we build our tools. And I think when we first created them and we didn't know that, you know, all these connected systems and networks were going to take over the world, I think we had a better excuse. But now that we know what kind of risk it can put people in, I think our obligation and our responsibility is higher than it's ever been.
And I think that I think you make a really good point that in addition to whatever kind of a high-minded civic ideal we might ask people to pursue, there is this obligation to each other, this kind of very, very local level accountability, where we can be having more conversations, where we just keep the social implications of the technologies that we're developing in mind in a way that maybe wasn't expected of us until recently.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you again for taking the time out to be on the show. And whenever you're working on something interesting and you'd like to share it with the audience, we'd love to have you back.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
Huge thanks to Anil for being on the show. In the blog post that goes with this week's episode, we'll link to Anil's Twitter so you can be one of his 500,000 followers if you aren't already, and to his website where you can learn more about all the cool projects that he's working on. You can find all of that on partiallyderivative.com. Until next time, you can follow us on Twitter @partiallyd and follow me @JonathanMorgan. We'll talk to you next time.